Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We've all forgotten many things. The names of kindergarten classmates get fuzzy past a certain age. I rarely recall people's numbers now that I have a phone to store them. Still, it's hard to imagine ever forgetting the names of your own children. Clark Elliott surely believed the same thing until a bump on the head in a car accident when he walked away from and indeed gave a 3-hour lecture just after resulted in a brain injury that produced strange and debilitating symptoms for the better part of 8 years, by which time he was close to quitting his job and losing custody of his children. Fortunately, as Elliott himself will tell us, those 8 years saw remarkable progress in neuroscience and revealed that he might be a candidate for a therapy course that sounds almost as strange as his injury. Clark Elliott is professor of artificial intelligence at DePaul University. His new book is called The Ghost in My Brain: How a Concussion Stole My Life and How the New Science of Brain Plasticity Helped Me Get It Back. Clark, welcome to Think.
Chris, thank you so much for having me on.
Of all the surprising things in this book, the stunner comes right at the beginning, which is that lots of people who are affected by brain injury from concussion are walking around not even realizing it.
Yes, that is so true, Chris. The story I tell in the book is my own story, and I think it's interesting in the way it conveys so much about how the human brain is put together. But ultimately, I'm not important. What does matter is the 6 million Americans that are known to be walking around today with long-term effects from brain damage, and in addition to 5,000 Americans that will report having a concussion between this time now and the same time tomorrow.
Hmm. How commonly can attention problems be traced to brain injury?
Well, this is one of my own strong intuitions, and I can't say that I have seen the science behind this because the treatments that I went through are relatively new in the world of science, but I see such a strong overlap between the symptoms of attention disorders and learning problems, or at least some subset of them, and the kinds of difficulties that many people with concussions also experience.
One thing that's so bizarre about the accident that made your life so difficult was that in the immediate aftermath, you seemed basically okay. Can you talk about that day and what you remember?
This is something that's very insidious about concussion, Chris, is it's often true that the things that go missing, and they can be quite profound parts of ourselves, but those things that go missing are often hard to realize because the machinery that it takes to understand they're missing has disappeared. I can give you a couple of examples. First, a simple one, and then one a little bit more serious. If I said to you, Chris, could you please pick up that big blue box in the corner? We would know that that sounds normal. But if I said instead, Chris, could you please pick up that blue big box in the corner, the blue big box? We'd know that there was something wrong about the syntax, but it's just one of the thousands of things that we get right as human beings during the day without realizing it. And so when something like that word ordering disappears, or our ability to understand which way is north when we're inside a building, when those little parts of us disappear, it's very difficult for us to understand what has happened. We just have a sense of loss. In a more serious example, at times of brain stress, I would lose the right-hand side of my world. I might, for example, look at a number line, and I could understand the numbers on the left, but as the numbers got greater toward the right, I wouldn't really understand that they were there. And in the same way, if I'm thinking about a calendar, I could understand the concept of yesterday, but not very well the concept of tomorrow. And yet, if you'd asked me, Clark Elliott, how are you feeling? I might say, well, a little strange, but I think I'm all right. And the difficulty would be that I couldn't tell you the right-hand side of my world is missing because the machinery that would allow me even to conceive of it being missing is gone.
Hmm. Of course, you have a PhD. You're a professor of artificial intelligence. You arguably have a lot of intellectual capacity to draw on to hide this from everybody else.
I did. You know, I had many resources, and it's also true that in my life as a professor, and just dispositionally as part of my personality throughout my life, I was used to solving hard problems. The job of a professor is pick something that hasn't been solved and make progress on it or solve it. So although the difficulties in this case were now just getting through the day, one foot after another, from morning until night, the task of my life of taking on hard problems and solving them were something that I was quite used to. And I think it's common with head injuries that we want to appear normal and we want to get on with our lives. And it's also true that very few people can understand what's going on inside of us. So we fake it. And I got very good at faking it and using those resources that I had at my disposal.
We should be clear that you were not in complete denial about this. You did seek medical treatment after a time. Why didn't neurological testing reveal anything that might have led to useful treatment earlier in the course of your recovery from this injury?
There are two answers to that, Chris. First, I did seek medical attention. I went to the hospital three times. I was there 7 hours in my first trip to the emergency room. I had MRIs, CT scans. I sought the best neurological groups. Every possible avenue for treating head injury was something that I pursued. But none of that helped. And in addition, it's not just that I didn't get lucky to find the right medical treatments. I was told over and over again, there is no treatment. Clark Elliott, you will get better maybe in a month, maybe in 6 months, maybe in a year. And at 2 years, you might see a last step up. But after that, no one ever recovers. With this kind of injury, it's permanent. You will never get better. So there was no treatment.
And there were some tests that you were given that made it seem as if you were perfectly fine. People, some of the doctors you talked to essentially said, maybe you feel weird, but you're fine.
Unfortunately, that's true. And from what I am hearing now after the release of the book, from all over the world is people writing and saying, Clark Elliott, your experiences are my own experience, except it was not back in 1999. This happened to me last month. And that is that if you look at an MRI scan, it's most common that the kind of damage from mild traumatic brain injury, concussions, doesn't show up, that the damage takes place in the synapses or inside the sheathing of neurons, and we can't see it on the gross view we get from an MRI exam. And at other times, I might have, I was given cognitive tests, but they were inappropriately given, and I know that they are still being inappropriately given, and I can give an example. I was given one test where I was to count backwards by sevens, and at the same time, I was to remember a few words in the background. Well, ordinarily, this is not a problem for a PhD in computer science to count backward by sevens and remember a couple of words. But at the end of that 3 or 4 minute test, I was completely debilitated. I couldn't walk. I would not have been able to repeat the test. I'm sweating and in quite a bit of nausea. But that data was not recorded. The only thing that was noted was, oh, perfect score. And then another problem that can happen is if you were given another test after that, let's say recalling something from memory, which ordinarily is not part of my constellation of symptoms or was not at the time, I would be unable to do that because I was exhausted for the first test. And I've tried to explain, this test is not a problem for me. I just can't do it because I can't talk right now because of the first test. And none of that kind of data is recorded. So there were challenges with the kinds of tests and the kind of testing I was given. And generally speaking, most of the physicians were very good-hearted and, did recognize that I had a brain injury. But sometimes others were quite cavalier about it and say, oh, well, I don't see anything. You should be fine.
So, Clark, I have to ask you about this. The thought of not being able to multitask reliably and finding yourself physically and also intellectually spent by certain tasks, that makes it really hard to be a dad.
Yes, it does, Chris. And are you a mother also?
I am.
Then you know well that children need us when they need us. And it's also true, especially with young children, that we have to keep two things or three things going at one time, that they need us to listen to them and keep them safe when they're very young. But we also have to go about the rest of our day. So that was very challenging when my youngest daughter, who was with me all the time as a single parent, was 2 years old and 3 years old. That was difficult because, as is common with these head injuries, I had completely lost the ability to multitask. This is a very common symptom.
So how did you cope with the things that you had to get done for a very young child? One thing that's interesting, too, we should talk about this. You did feel like you were able to drive safely, but then sometimes you would like lose your car and have trouble getting into the car physically.
This was a godsend, and I was extremely, excruciatingly careful about not driving if I suspected that the symptoms from my head injury would be a problem. If I was fine when I started driving, the act of driving itself was actually relatively restorative, and it was something about the passing of images along the periphery of my vision, which later, as we'll see if we talk about the treatment I received, does make sense. So I would focus straight ahead, and these objects passing along my periphery would tend to restore my cognitive state. But sometimes it's true, as you'll note in the opening of the book, I almost died several times just trying to walk across the frozen park in downtown Chicago getting to my car when my body stopped moving and I was left standing there in the snow and the bitter wind for an hour at a time. But once I did make it inside my car, I would just sit there for sometimes 2 hours, maybe even 3 hours, staring at a tree, letting my body recover and recover. And an interesting aspect of concussion also, which I do hear echoed in those who have written to me as their experience also, is that I had emergency resources that I could draw on so that if I were driving and I needed to jam on the brakes or attend to an emergency situation, my reflexes were normal and I could respond in the normal way. But the difficulty was that this was quite taxing, and it would take a toll that sometimes might last 2 or 3 days, depending on the kinds of drain I placed on my resources. But other than that, driving could work. Finding my car was another story altogether.
At what point did you decide to keep a journal of the symptoms you were experiencing? I sort of love that throughout all this, you couldn't help being a scientist and wanting to at least catalog everything that was going on.
There is a certain irony, Chris, in a professor who studies the human brain, which I had done for decades as an artificial intelligence scientist, gets a head injury. So as challenging as my days were, I did take a certain delight in, you know, observing the minute workings of my brain as it broke down. And it presented a fascinating world into how our brains work, which I hope I've captured in the book. In some ways, I felt I had a unique window into this because while my cognition slowed so greatly, it might, for example, take me 2 to 3 minutes just to reach out to grab a salt shaker at the worst of times. But my ability to observe this, what we call the metacognitive voice, was running in real time, so I could observe this breakdown in great detail. And I started taking the notes even from the second day after the accident. Things that were happening to me, Chris, were so bizarre. It's just, if you haven't been through it, you can't understand what it's like to just no longer be human anymore, to be inside a body looking out. And that part of us that was human and normal is just so completely gone. And all that's left is to watch the machinery running. It's a quite dramatic change over being normal. So I started scribbling notes down. I had them on Post-it notes, and I would write them on pieces of paper that I would stuff in envelopes. And interestingly, in those first 6 months, I couldn't actually read at the time. So I had all of these disorganized computer files and notes and papers in my office and at home. But I did write down the dates, and I was scrupulous about recording the exact details of my experience.
Clark Elliott is my guest. He's professor of artificial intelligence at DePaul University and author of the new book, The Ghost in My Brain, How a Concussion Stole My Life and How the New Science of Brain Plasticity Helped Me Get It Back. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of Artificial Intelligence at DePaul University, Clark Elliott. His new memoir is called The Ghost in My Brain, How a Concussion Stole My Life and How the New Science of Brain Plasticity Helped Me Get It Back. You can be part of the conversation at think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Clark, when you talk about not feeling fully human, like an observer of your own life, that sounds very lonely. And you describe in the book a number of incidents in which this really did affect your relationships. Notably, you managed to inadvertently deeply offend a neighbor who was trying to talk to you about something when you were disturbed, I guess, by a loud sound and sort of put your hands over your ears and collapsed to the ground.
This was quite common. Situations were often difficult. I couldn't tolerate certain kinds of sounds. For example, if people tried to say something that contained too much information that required visualization on my part, I could only last for a short time. In faculty meetings or if I attended a lecture, I could only last for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then I had to find a way to escape the room before I lost the ability to walk. In the incident you're talking about, an old man who lived down the alley from me drove his car down the alley, and he wanted me to cut the bushes near the corner of the street. And he pulled up as I was playing baseball outside with one of my sons. Now, following the baseball for my son who was in Little League was extremely challenging for me, and I did it because my son needed it, but it left me very, very debilitated. This neighbor's car had squeaky disc brakes, so as he pulled up and rolled down his window to talk to me, the squeaking from the brakes was something I couldn't tolerate. This sensory overload is something that concussives often experience. It's like having a bell lowered over your head with somebody beating on it with a sledgehammer while someone else is putting sulfur in your nose. And it left me on the street in fetal position, holding my ears, covering my ears with my hands. And the neighbor drove away. Well, this ended up happening again, and he got so offended that I was ignoring him and making a big show of being a baby in front of my own child that he came out and cut down all the trees in my front yard in retaliation. In another case, I was walking slowly after shopping at the nearby grocery store because that's the best I could do, is one foot and then the next foot. And a woman got mad. She thought, I guess, I was walking slowly just to make trouble for her, so she tried to run me down, and it was a close call. I just barely got out of the way.
What did you tell your kids about this? Were they protective of you? Were they embarrassed of you? Did it go back and forth?
My kids were great. You know, kids are so adaptable. I think of a time when I was traveling with my then five-year-old son, Paul, and I was taking him to California to visit his grandmother, and I couldn't get down the jetway because of the parallel lines that appear in the structure of the jetway. I couldn't walk past them. So I say, Paul, I can't walk. Could you push me down the jetway? And he'd say, sure, Dad. And he'd happily push me down the jetway. And for him, this was normal. And, you know, we adapted. I couldn't always answer math problems when one of my daughters needed help, because it would mean I would be just 3 minutes of doing the math would mean I could no longer cook dinner. So instead, I would stay up at night and leave answers the next morning. And they just got used to that as being normal.
Tell us about the incidents you had where you knew you had a number of children and you could not call their names to mind immediately.
You had referred to this when we started. And this was a test I gave myself at the end of 8 years. So this is 8 years after the crash. And I was at the point where I just couldn't keep going anymore. It was just so difficult to get through a single day. And the key, the trick to getting through it all was to know what resources I had that day so that I could marshal them and only take on challenges that I could manage. So the test was to get up in the morning and name my five children. It wasn't actually a problem with memory. It was a problem of conceiving, first of what children are, what the number five means, how faces relate to people, and so on. So on good days, of course, it would take me about 6 seconds to name my five children in the normal way. On bad days, it would take me over 3 minutes, and even then I wasn't quite sure. And I knew on those days, take on no challenges at all except the basics of being a father and teaching my classes.
What you just said is a great way to get us into the idea that the brain is a far more complex instrument than we realize. And you list in the book this figure that each of us is walking around with the power of 50 million networked PCs under our skulls.
That's right. One human brain, this is the AI professor here giving a 15-second lecture, but one human brain is roughly equivalent to 50 million desktop computers, as you have pointed out. If we laid them end-to-end, they would stretch from here to Beijing with another 3,000 miles to spare. And that's not even the most fascinating parts of what a human brain are. I talk about memory and also the construction of the human mind in the book, which is even more staggering. These are by far the most complex computational devices on Earth.
So you said at the end of 8 years, you really were at the end of your rope. And it was sort of by sheer coincidence that you were connected with someone who thought she might be able to help you.
Yes. And I want to give the website for the book, clarkelliott.com, where I have resources not only to the people I will talk about, but to many other resources, such as the 700 scholarly articles on the science behind this and various endorsements for the book. I did get lucky, and I met a woman named Donnelly Marcus, who is a cognitive restructuring specialist, almost by chance. This was a last gasp effort before I had to give up my job, really give up everything. I would have lost my house, custodianship of my children, and so on. And this was a last attempt to find someone. I read a book by Norman Doidge called The Brain That Changes Itself, a fabulous book that championed the idea of brain plasticity. And using that term, brain plasticity, I found Donnelly Marcus, who practices just north of Chicago. And she then immediately referred me to her colleague, the optometrist Deborah Zielinski, who uses neurodevelopmental optometric techniques to reconfigure brains. Donnelly Marcus uses paper and pencil puzzles, of all things, and Deborah Zielinski uses prescription eyeglasses.
Prescription eyeglasses. Now, this sounds crazy, and you explain it beautifully in the book, but why in the world would that make a difference? Because your eyesight was fine.
Yes. And I do want to point out, this is not voodoo science. There is a long tradition behind both of these treatments. And the book itself has been endorsed by, among others, the Dean Emeritus of the Harvard School of Medical Education and past president of the American College of Physicians. This is real science, believe it or not. The prescription eyeglasses were used, in my case, to bend the light coming through my retinas to a healthy part of my brain. That is, much of my processing was going through the damaged parts of my brain that happened because of the minor car crash, wasn't functioning properly. But we did have healthy tissue in my brain. Deborah Zielinski found it, and she routed the retinal signals through those healthy parts of my brain back to the visual cortex. And we can think of this as carving a dirt road through the brain. Now, one thing we might ask is, well, if the brain is so complex, why would treating vision of all things, or your eyes, your retinas, that doesn't seem like it would be very important. But as an AI scientist, I know that at least 30%, almost everyone will agree that at least 30% of the brain is involved quite directly with visual spatial processing. And estimates are as high as 50 to 80% of the brain is involved in visual spatial processing at some point. We are, at our core, primarily visual spatial beings. It's what makes us human. And that's why treating these retinal inputs and the retinal changes in the brain that we can make are so very powerful. Having carved this dirt road through my brain, using the idea of brain plasticity, this healthy tissue could take over the functioning for that parts of my brain that were damaged. And then using these pencil and paper puzzles, Deborah Donnelly Marcus turned those dirt roads through rehearsal over and over again with these puzzles into the superhighways that once again let me function fully as a professor. And when I was done with their treatments, I was completely and fully recovered.
We have an interesting tweet here from Sid who says, concussion issues seem similar to many autism processing issues. How can you tell which it is, and would these be treatable in the same way?
Here again, I won't claim the science, and I am not a scientist in this area, but I do have absolutely the strongest intuition because of my own experiences and my own observations that the treatments that worked for me, by reconfiguring my brain using brain plasticity techniques, and in particular also based on extensive neurodevelopmental optometric testing, which can show all kinds of interesting difficulties that someone may have that ordinarily go flying under the radar, that these techniques can be used to treat other kinds of symptoms, other kinds of conditions. I can't speak directly to autism, but I do know that Deborah Zielinski and Donnelly Marcus both work with patients that have autism. And I also believe that there's a strong link between learning disabilities and the kinds of symptoms and difficulties that I had prior to my treatment. When I look at some children with learning difficulties, I see, oh, that looks an awful lot like what my life was like at the same time. And yet, we can also raise the question, how many hidden brain injuries have gone undetected that are causing these learning disabilities? But even if we discount that, I think we can raise the question, could the treatments that worked so well for me also work for these children? And lastly, post-traumatic stress disorder also seems to share many of the same symptoms. So if we look at blast victims, for example, so common in our military that return with difficulties from these wars overseas, a common diagnosis is post-traumatic stress disorder. And I think we have to ask the question, how many of these diagnoses actually might be changed if someone understood brain injury in the way that my healers did and that I do myself? I think that sometimes we might have a different diagnosis. And even if the post-traumatic stress disorder was purely chemical in nature, from the trauma to the brain from the stress, I think we could raise the question, could the treatments that work so well for me also work for those victims as well?
Clark, earlier you mentioned that one of the things you struggled with was word order in pretty simple communications. And I'm wondering if you're familiar with the Daniel Keyes novella Flowers for Algernon.
Yes. Fortunately, I was like flowers for, you know, the flower for Algernon story, except that I am now fully recovered, and so far I have not taken a single step backward.
Right. No, I didn't mean to imply that, but I think the story is beautifully written. For people who are not familiar with it, it's someone who has been affected by like a scientific experiment. The story is complete science fiction, but you can see the way this character communicates changing. He goes from having limited cognitive abilities to being like incredibly smart, and then he recesses. But I wonder if when you look back through your journals, you can see a change in the way that you were even recording your own thoughts and observations.
Yes, Chris, forgive me for missing that. You are absolutely correct. One thing I had to be very careful about in my professional life was sending out email that looked like a mentally ill person.
Hmm.
I think of an example from the book that I was writing about a 10-year meeting. But in the process of writing the word meeting, I thought for a moment, oh, where's that file that has that information in it? And the F from file got confused in my mind, and I turned meeting into feeding. And then feeding, I knew, was not a word, so I changed that to feeling. And I caught myself just before I sent out an email message to my professional colleagues about tenure feeling or tenure. And I thought, this is not appropriate. I had to over and over again watch out. What am I sending to my students? What am I sending to my colleagues? You were absolutely correct about that. And this is part of the global change that just makes us feel so much non-human. This is the joke among concussives I've met is, welcome to the alien club. Welcome to no longer being part of the human race. And it's very, very disconcerting. I think for many, this in itself is the hardest part.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Ava on the line in Dallas. Hi, Ava. Ava, are you with us?
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Oh, Ava. Hi.
Hello. Go right ahead, Ava.
So I had a concussion in April.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a concussion in April, and it was difficult for my teachers to understand what was going on. They did make accommodations. But some people thought that I was, like, perfectly normal or that I was, like, faking it because I could do some things very normally. I could I could speak normally and things, but I had trouble with memory.
That sounds like something you can probably relate to, Clark, the fact that it's not obvious when people run into you that there's a problem.
First of all, Eva, my heart goes out to you. I understand at least some of what you're going through, and I can hear it in your voice. This is a challenge for people who have concussions, is that others raise expectations for them because they don't understand what it's like. So I could imagine Eva, for example, doing fine on a task in the class for, 5 minutes or 10 minutes. And then later in the day, after having trouble with processing some sound from a fan that's running in the background or some visual pattern that has set her off, and I'm inventing these symptoms for Eva, but something that could be a challenge. And then later in the day, given that same task, she can't perform it at all. Now her teacher or her classmates say, oh, you're faking it because I saw you do that this morning. And inside, Eva is thinking, I was able to complete that task, but it's now going to take me 2 or 3 days to recover from that 10 minutes worth of work. I can give an episode that I think is striking, similar maybe to what is happening to Eva, although in Ava's case, they recognize she has a concussion, thank goodness. At a party at a beach where my daughter was participating with some friends, I noticed one of these friends, and we're talking now 8-year-old girls, was having some difficulty, and as I watched her, I thought, uh-oh, that looks like me. So I asked her mother, how is, let's just say, June doing? And the mother said, oh, well, now you ask. She's not doing well at all. We're having so much trouble with her in school. And finally, you know, we have her now in behavior modification after school. She complains all the time how she doesn't want to do math, and she doesn't want to study. So we force her to sit down for 2 hours every day after school getting that math done. And I said, is there any chance she slipped on the ice or fell off her bike? And the mother said, oh, my goodness, she slipped on the ice, a year ago. And I said, well, what happened? You know, and they said, oh, well, she was sick for a week. She had a concussion, but then she was fine. Later, they took her back to the doctor. The woman came and said, oh, my goodness, Clark Elliott, thank you. She has a brain injury. We didn't realize it, and we were doing absolutely the wrong thing in school.
Let me jump in here. My guest is Clark Elliott. We're talking about his new book, The Ghost in My Brain. We'll be back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Clark Elliott. He's professor of artificial intelligence at DePaul University and author of The Ghost in My Brain, How a Concussion Stole My Life and How the New Science of Brain Plasticity Helped Me Get It Back. Join us at 1-800-933-5372, which is where we find Bill on the line in Grand Prairie. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I'm 3.5 months removed from my accident. I hit my head a slab of concrete, and it was just a slip and fall. Mm-hmm. My question to you is, it doesn't seem like a lot of the TBI-related tests have been socialized. So do you know of tests or like neuropsych tests that actually will, that for people with traumatic brain injuries, it seems like it's, the testing portion is more generic. Also, did you have anything to take for the headaches? Mine's begin after 12 o'clock, after I've had all the appointments in the morning, and they're debilitating. They will wear me out. I sleep for 4 or 5 hours, get up for 2, and then sleep another 8 hours to get rid of the headaches.
Thanks for your call, Bill.
Bill, first, my heart goes out to you as well. And I understand how extremely debilitating these appointments can be, even sometimes just getting to the appointments. And a minor slip and fall can cause horrendous damage to one's brain, especially if we're talking about impact with concrete. I also found that the testing that was given to me was generally inappropriate. It was not revealing what the actual problems were. If you go to a neuro-optometric, a neurodevelopmental optometric optometrist, someone that specializes in these techniques, they will give you 2 to 3 hours of testing using things like the Padula Visual Midline Shift Test, the King-Devick Reading Test, the Lange Stereo Test, a Yoked Prism Walk, the Selwyn Super Fixation Disparity Test, Van Graaff, and so on. I could go on and on. These are not tests that your typical neurologist is familiar with, and they won't know how to interpret the results. But sometimes these can be extremely revealing. Now, I don't know, of course, what is wrong in your case, but for a couple of hours of testing and an office visit, to me, this seems crucial information, especially if there's a head injury. But I would also recommend it just for general health, the same as you would go to get your ordinary eyesight tested. I also want to comment that the difficulty is that so many don't know about the availability of these tests, but there is strong science behind them. And if you look at the ClarkElliott.com website, you can see practitioners that give these tests associated with the Neuro-Optometric Rehabilitation Association. That's NORA, and their website is nora.cc. So ClarkElliott.com has some resources. Your experience, Bill, is not alone. So many people that write to me say, for 5 years, for 6 years, I've gone to see neurologists. They don't understand my condition. It's exhausting for me to go. The cognitive tests they give me are not appropriate, and so on. And this is not a knock on physicians. You know, they are able to save people's lives, which is a superpower that I certainly don't have. But it is true that they often don't understand some of the science that is out there.
I want to talk about the title of your book, The Ghost in My Brain, because when you received the treatment that finally made this huge difference for you, you experienced something very unusual.
In the first week of after getting my prescription eyeglasses that were bending the light to a different part of my brain and starting the brain puzzles that Donald Lee Marcus had given me, I started to experience this strange feeling of something like an apparition or a presence following me around over my right shoulder. And I thought, this is really odd. Up until this point, I thought, I'm having many difficulties with sensory input, but I'm completely logical. This was something that was different. After 2 weeks, it was getting closer, about 10 feet away. After 3 weeks, it was about 3 feet away. And during this period, my body also was experiencing this explosion of life back into the world. Chris, I was dancing down the hallways at DePaul University as I felt my body re-experiencing the world. I understood what a doorway was. I could make sense of what a stair meant and what the simple concepts like before and after meant for the first time in 8 years. And then in this grand and fabulous moment that I will never forget, outside my office at 9 o'clock one evening after teaching a lecture, I felt that this presence that was so close to me, I thought, oh, that's me returning. This is the boy that used to ride his bicycle up to the University of California at 10 years old to study math and physics and just loved the symbols of thought that way and sailed his boat around San Francisco Bay and loved music so passionately his whole life. That person was coming back. And I just went into my office and tears of joy, you know, flowed down my face from this great gift I had been given that I thought I would never see again. Mm-hmm.
What kind of spectacles do you wear today? What's the prescription like?
These are ordinary prescription glasses, the same as you could get from any lab and any optometrist. It's just that the secret is in the prescription. In my current pair, these are my sixth pair that I've gotten from Deborah Zielinski. I have a very, very slight prism built into them. But other than that, it's just very careful balance between my left eye and my right eye. In the first pair of glasses, we emphasized the left-hand side of my world and also blurred the center vision a little bit and emphasized my peripheral processing to help me set the context for executive functioning. I don't have time to go into the details here, but between the first, second, and third pairs of glasses over the course of about a year and a half, I was almost fully recovered. And since then, they were just minor tweaks, but these are normal, ordinary prescription glasses.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak now with David in Weatherford. Hi, David.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I just had an aha moment listening to your guest. I'm 66 and I recently retired, and my whole life and my career, there have been issues that I've had to adjust to realize that I can live in the same office building and work in the same office building for 10 years, but still never tell anybody the address. So I always cheat and have some kind of cheat sheet so I can look it up. Hmm. Well, when I was 3 years old, I fell a full story, landed on my head and cracked my, actually had a skull fracture completely. And now this all kind of makes sense with some of the things that I've had to compensate for over the years, almost like a dyslexia type thing and the rest of it. So I think I'm going to have to read your book.
You know, David, in my case, it was 8 years, 8 years, and I was told you'll never get better. And in the course of 3 weeks, I was about 70% recovered. My case is unusual, but I have to believe that there is at least hope that even after 63 years, you might have an identified problem that could be treated.
Clark, how did those 8 years when you were told you would not get better, how did that affect your identity, your sense of who you were?
I was lucky. Many people with these head injuries do experience quite serious depression. And I think they also experience that strong alienation that I described. And the combination of the alienation and sadness, depression, can lead to very difficult outcomes. Sometimes, you know, we know the rate of suicide is actually significantly higher for people with brain injuries. But in my case, I was lucky about that. I never had depression, and I was so busy getting through just one day at a time, I really didn't have time to think about that. And then additionally, Chris, as you will know, I was a parent, and much of the time I was a single parent. And with five children, there was no choice. I had to keep going. I had to solve the problems. So I certainly absolutely felt that I was not human, but I didn't experience any kind of debilitating depression or sadness. But there's no doubt, absolutely, that I felt this sense of loss over who I used to be and finally realizing it would never come back. And I remember sitting in my living room one morning realizing that person is never coming here again. I will never know him. I will never be able to enjoy music in the same way. I won't ever feel human. My sense of emotions is going to be changed permanently. And whatever else comes, it's just serendipity, but that life is over.
We have an email from Sandra who's curious as to whether you know if this kind of research is being applied to people who have things like dementia and Alzheimer's disease, and if those who are studying it believe there might be potential.
I can say the following. Both Deborah Zielinski and Donald E. Marcus do work with dementia patients. They also work with autism patients and those with dyslexia. And I think they would be conservative in their claims, but I think they would also say their belief is that they can at least often make some of these people more comfortable. Because if there are attendant visual difficulties, visual spatial difficulties, which get down right to the core of our thinking and who we are, if we can fix some of those, we're going to make anyone more comfortable.
Were you skeptical at the start of your treatment?
Oh, absolutely. Paper and pencil puzzles and eyeglasses? I said, this can't be right. I've seen the most, you know, brilliant physicians in the area, and they couldn't do anything. But in this great moment, Deborah Zielinski, you know, had gone through, she looked over the 2 hours of testing and performed another hour on her own. And I had a stack of notes I wanted to go over with her that I had written up. You know, I took 1,200 pages of notes of my experience over the years. And she turned to me and said, well, first of all, I read the notes while you were being tested. And second, I don't need to go over them with you. She said, I know what's wrong with you. I thought, what? No one has ever said this other than you have a concussion and it's hopeless. She said, I know what's wrong with you. And then as she was walking away to work with other other patients, she turned back over her shoulder and smiled and said, and I know how to fix it. And you know what? She did.
We have an email here from Jenny who says, a lot of the symptoms you're describing seem to apply to my 9-year-old foster daughter. Since I don't know her history prior to the age of 6, should I consider having her evaluated for a brain injury?
If the symptoms look the same, I would say yes. The testing that I mentioned, and I'll just say one last time, at clarkelliott.com, I do point to the NORA organization that has many practitioners that can give these tests. The testing is not invasive. We're not talking about surgery. We're not talking about drugs. It's just purely informational. And I would say if you suspect that these symptoms, which are very common, you know, the symptoms I give in the book, I'm hearing from so many people. Thank you for putting that in words. That's what's happening to me, and I can't explain it to others. If those symptoms match what is in the book, absolutely, why not go for testing? Just think, you know, if this child is suffering a midline shift and that's what's causing such catastrophic difficulties with cognition, that's something that can be fixed and it's an easy test to find it.
Does your experience worry you for people who are involved, young people in particular, with contact sports? We've talked on this show about, you know, the mild traumatic brain injuries that build up over years among some young athletes.
Chris, I am passionate about this. I have a couple of comments. First, I want to refer to a study done in New Zealand with about 60 rugby players over the course of two seasons. They gave baseline testing using simple, simple tests, cheap tests such as King-Devick, which is a three-minute reading test, and a couple of other paper questionnaires. They tested all the athletes for baseline testing before the season. Then during the season, they tested all of the athletes again, repeatedly, not just those that had reported concussions, where they knew a concussion took place. And what they found was that for every concussion they knew about, five more concussions, five more brain injuries were flying under the radar.
Wow.
All right, so we have to be suspicious that there are five or six times as many concussions occurring as we know about, and yet we are sending these young people back out on the field, and they are at risk. Second thing, concussion damage is permanent. Now, in the course of a month, those 5,000 people experiencing concussions a day, most of those will feel better. That's because the brain is plastic and it has a ways to work around the damage that can occur. But that doesn't mean that the damage is not permanent. That's why we are at risk for second concussions being much more catastrophic in their damage. So we now have the testing, simple paper and pencil tests, reading tests like King-Devick that are cheap, easily administered. I have to ask, why don't we give these tests to all of our athletes for baseline testing before the season and then test all of them during the season? It's the only way to find out who has had these brain injuries, because so many of them otherwise are going to go under the radar. Now, we give Americans the data. They can make their own choice. You might play with a broken, you know, a sprained ankle or a bad, you might pitch with a bad elbow. But you can't make a good decision without the data. We have that data, and it's almost criminal for us not to be giving this to high school athletes, the parents of these athletes, and the same at the college level. And then, of course, at the professional level, I have to ask, why aren't we giving these same tests as well? And then let the athletes choose for themselves whether or not they want to continue to play or they want to take time off.
Clark Elliott is professor of artificial intelligence at DePaul. His new book is The Ghost in My Brain, How a Concussion Stole My Life and How the New Science of Brain Plasticity Helped Me Get It Back. Clark, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Chris, thank you so much for having me on. Let's get some of these people well.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.